Blog Talk Radio.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard to live it, but I'm afraid to die. I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. Then I go to my brother. Say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Lord, there have been times that I thought I could last for long. But I know a change gon' come. Oh, yes it will.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of Let's Talk Fort Worth. I'm Carrie Hines, your host. Thank you for joining us for what should be another great show. A reminder, we do not own the rights to the music you just heard. Also, please click tag and share. Tell someone Let's Talk Fort Worth is on the air. And tonight, we're talking about the Timothy Simpkins trial. Was he given a fair trial? Was it a jury of his peers? Did they allow all the evidence in? Should he have gotten probation? Was it smart for Timothy to take the trial in his own defense? And should life in prison even have been an option, seeing that no one was killed? That's what we're talking about tonight, y'all. Let's go behind the scenes of the Timothy Simpkins trial. All right, y'all, with that said, I'm having technical difficulties tonight. I don't know, when we do these kind of shows, for some kind of reason, all kind of stuff just kind of breaks haywire. And I'm looking at my switchboard, and I don't see anything that's normal going on my switchboard, which is not typical. So, again, when we do shows involving police brutality, anything dealing with any serious downtown situations where courts, having high-profile cases, all of a sudden, things get really strange. So tonight, we're going to give my switchboard a second to recalibrate, and we're going to see what happens here. But just a second ago, it was completely black, which is something that it never happens unless we're dealing with topics that they don't want us to talk about. And so I'm just going to call on my angels tonight to deal with the airwaves and any type of interference that may be coming against us in this particular situation. But this week, y'all, we watched the Timothy Simpkins trial. A lot to be said about the judge, the DA, a lot of the things that we saw in terms of the bailiffs appearing to single activists out, and even one of our co-hosts was called out because they were taking notes in the courtroom, and the bailiff called them outside of the courtroom and decided that they wanted to know what were they writing and actually asked to see the notes. So were there a lot of strange things going on that we saw? Yeah. I had friends that were in the courtroom and also watched myself the trial live. So just from observation, I saw it to be a very tense environment. I typically don't have the nerve to go into those types of environments without saying more than I needed to say or need to say and get myself in trouble. So it's easier for me to report on them outside of the courtroom than it is for me to go, because when I see things that are considered unfair, I'm always one that wants to speak out. Now, y'all, I'm trying to get to my switchboard again, and I'm having a little difficulties, but I never panic, so give me a second to try to figure out what the heck is going on. But my co-host, if they would send me a text and see if and let me know if there's anything going on with their getting into the switchboard, that would kind of help me to know where we are. But give me a second. So I saw the family of Timothy Simpkins this week. I saw a mother who was crying her eyes out about her son. And I saw a lot of people. Well, one of my co-hosts is on, so I'm good. As soon as I can get into the switchboard, I can open up their phone lines and we can get going. But I saw a former girlfriend of Timothy Simpkins, and my heart went out to her. I saw that young lady shaking like a leaf on a tree as she was trying to testify. And the DA or the prosecutor by the name of Salinas was not giving her any mercy. It was as though she was just badgering. Okay, there we go, y'all. My switchboard is open. There we go. Adrian, can you hear me? Christopher, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Woo! I forgot to call on the angels. I don't know what I was doing. I typically always send the angels ahead on these shows to prepare the atmosphere and deal with any interference, and I forgot tonight or this evening. I just got so busy, I won't do that again, and I forgot to follow my normal routine. But that said, good evening, y'all.
Hey.
Hey, Jerry.
Hey. So, y'all, Adrian, you were in the courtroom on last Friday. Give us a feel for what you saw as you were there in the courtroom last Friday.
Okay, I'll begin with just basically, it was like you could hear a pin drop. Yeah, you had those moments. I think the overall, you looked at how everything was laid out, you know, as far as you had the media there, then of course you had the family represented on one side, and it seemed to be, everybody, I guess, as it relates to the prosecution side to the far left, and then I think the attorneys outside of the prosecution and defense, that first back bench in the middle, I think that's where they more or less had their counterparts, to help them with the trial proceedings. Because, we had the three on the defensive side, but the prosecutor had, two prosecutors, but they had, three individuals directly behind them. And I don't know what all role they played in relation to the prosecution, but they were there, you know. I think it was one of those moments. It kind of took me back to the with it being so high profile, you know, it was like I tell you this. I had a sense of concern. I had a sense of uncertainty about some things, but overall, just being there, being able to witness it and take it all in, you know, it gave me a better perspective as it relates to high profile trials. And I took it upon myself to start trying to jot down some things that I was observing, other things I was observing, you know, so I could better bring myself into the space of everything, you know, because I think last Friday was the last official day other than Monday when they did the sentencing phase, you know.
So tell us this. You were in the courtroom and you borrowed a piece of paper and you were taking notes. What happened when they or someone saw you taking notes?
Well, you know, I'm a real observant individual, so I pay attention to everything that's going on around me. I noticed, I think it was right after one of the recesses, and I noticed the bailiff up front kind of, he walked over to the judge. They had like a brief, brief exchange. But I'm sitting directly in the middle, you know, so I'm like 1, 2, 3 rows in the middle, and I'm sitting direct, like right in front of the judge, and they looked at me, but then the bailiff kind of motioned to the gentleman that was behind me, the bailiff that was to the left of the courtroom. As you come in the entrance, you know, you can go out to the left or the right. He was standing to the left, and I mean, look back, you know, to see what's going on with the motion. And so he stepped forward and said, "Sir, come here." And I'm like, "Oh, me?" He said, "Yeah, just come here." So he took me off, you know, we walked outside in the hallway, and he said, his question was like, he said, "Who are you here with?" I said, you know, I said, I'm here on my own. I'm here to observe the trial. I'm here on my own, you know, woo, woo, woo. You know, he said, "Can I see what you're writing?" I said, "Yeah." I just so happened to have my little note, took it out with me. So yeah, you can see. He put his glass on, started looking at it, and then I said, and I almost went to the point of, you know, that protest, like, "What's up? What's going on?" Then he looked at it, and he handed it back to me. Then by that time, the bailiff that was up in front of the courtroom, he came out, and as he was coming out, the gentleman was explaining to him. I said, "What's going on?" He said, "Oh, no." He said, "Somebody said that you were they saw you writing down something, jotting down notes or something as it relates to the jurors or something. Somebody apparently said that I was writing down something as it relates to the jurors, like jurors' description, this, that, or the other." But when he read it, he clearly seen it had nothing to do with jurors' description. On that piece of paper, particular piece of paper, I wrote down some observations that I thought about the judge, and then I did write down the breakup of the jury, you know, who was sitting in that box, the breakup, the breakdown of. So when he read it, he gave it back to me, and then the other guy, he reaffirmed it. Yeah, it's just security reasons. He said, "Somebody, we got to make sure the jury's, you know." I said, "What?" I said, and I asked, I straight up said, "Who?" I said, "Who said it?" You know, I'm like, "Who?" You know, but that's what it was. You know, they didn't make no big thing of it. You know, they were real professional, you know, this, that, or the other. They were real professional with it. So, but I was like, wow, you know.
But didn't you feel intimidated? Because to me, that's a form of intimidation.
I felt a sense of, like, yeah, I felt like, damn, I mean, like, I'm doing something wrong. It made me wonder who would do that, you know, what, you know.
I told Adrian, y'all, I think there's cameras that were in there, and they were probably honing in on certain people based on, you know, body movements or conversation or whatever, you know, they thought was going on. And so I believe someone who's watching from another room probably wanted to know what he was doing, and that's why they you know, came over to Adrian, because I just questioned, I mean, you just have a problem with a person taking notes in a trial.
And Carrie, and what you said, Carrie, you know, we had that conversation after the, you know, when we had that conversation offline, I said, you're right, Carrie. Now that I think of it, I explained that it's a camera directly under the judge. I mean, directly above the judge, it's a camera. So they probably zooming in on me, and I'm motioning at the jury, but I'm counting them. I'm counting the jury with my finger. So you're right. Somebody was.
I'm just saying. Well, and then you were counting the jury. What was the makeup of the jury?
The makeup of the jury was 14 members, and I could stand to be corrected on it.
Somewhere,
12. Yeah, they have all. It was two blacks. It was two blacks counted. I say when it came to Hispanic, like I said, you could give or take, because I put an asterisk by that. I would say three Hispanic, and I say the rest were white, you know.
Okay, were you there when they pulled the jury?
No, I was there. I came Friday, so I didn't see none of that. I was there Friday. I came Friday.
I don't know if they pulled the jury or not. I don't remember. But I was just curious if the two black people might have been in the alternate bunch if they weren't actually part of the verdict. Because, you know, for serious trials, they always have a couple of alternates that they have in case one of the juries falls out. Then there's two more that have seen all the evidence and they can replace them.
So where would the other two have gone? The trial wasn't that long. I'm just saying. Listen, y'all,
I see what you're saying, yeah.
But wouldn't they have to keep that jury pool, even though if they replaced a particular person of a, and maybe an attorney could speak to it, if they replaced someone of a particular, say they replaced one of the black jurors, wouldn't they have to put another, you know, as it relates to the makeup of the jury pool?
That's all in the panel, and it's all just set up. The question that I'm asking, the question I'm wanting to know is, okay, there's only 12 jurors that voted for the verdict. So after the trial's over and they go in, there's only 12 jurors' votes that count. Those other, you said that there were 14. They just have those other two sitting as alternates.
My count might have been off. Like I say, We'll get somebody to come on and verify my count. My count might have been off, so I'm just.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we only spent a whole lot of time on it, but I think I read in the paper it was 12. So if it was 12, you know, we only spent a whole bunch of time on it, but was it a jury of his peers is the question. And if 12 jurors, two black, you know, was it a fair, was that fair? You know, we know about Judge Ryan Hill. He was not elected. He was appointed by Governor Abbott. So I found that very suspicious. And then we had the attorneys, the prosecutors, Salinas, and we also had the prosecutor, Lloyd Welchel, out of Paris,
Texas.
The
question that I have, Adrian, what was the age dimension of the jurors?
It was a mixed age dynamic. Probably the youngest. That's what I'm saying. It was a mixed age. I say probably the youngest. Looked probably early, probably mid-30s, early 30s, and then you just go from there.
And so there you have. I mean, I'm questioning about the whole concept of jury of your peers. If if you're 18, 19, 20 years old, I mean that's a generation gap. You know,
but. Let's on now as far as jury, because we want to get an understanding of that. So we asked, how do they determine when they say jury or your peers, what does that specifically mean? So we can wait for the attorney to come on and answer that question.
Okay. Yeah, we're trying to get one of our attorneys to come on tonight. I think he's going to try to chime in about 7:30 if we're lucky. And we also talked to the Simpkin family today, and we're hoping to hear from their spokesperson. We're not going to ask any, you know, specific questions. We just want to hear from them and whatever they're willing to tell us. How was the trial in their opinion, you know, and whatever else. Like I said, we're not, you know, because we know there's a lot of legality still, you know, looming. So whatever they're willing to talk about, that's what we want to hear about. So just leaving it open. But we did speak with the mother, who's a very nice lady today. And she, I spoke with her briefly, and she said she would consult with her attorney, which I think was either Mark Clayton or Lisa Pamplin, and I forgot what the other attorney name is, Shauna, something like that. And they would tell her whether or not they could speak. So I look, you know, I pray that we can speak with them just for a better understanding. Because, you know, when you're watching, I'm just like too, like, radical, I'd say, to be sitting in a courtroom and see stuff that I knew I didn't like. So that type of environment, I don't do well in. But Adrian did go. He's more cool-headed than me. And so, but we just want to know, what did it feel like to be in there, to be in the mix of things and knowing that people are saying life, 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 as the prosecutor, Salinas, was saying. I didn't agree with the fact that Salinas said he was a killer. To me, that is absolutely misrepresenting the actual course of events. No one was killed. And so for her to say on more than one occasion that he was a killer, I wasn't sure how that came into play and why she was allowed to say that. So I'd love for an attorney to explain to me how that was. And if Lisa Pamplin or Mark Clayton would like to call in tonight and tell us, you know, something about what's going on. Somebody just texted me, y'all, and I'm trying to see what the text says. But if they would like to call in, okay, so the attorney is getting ready to call. We're gonna he's gonna chime in just a second and give us some clarity on some things. But
Carrie, I was to add to your quote real quick. I actually heard once or twice cold-blooded killer, and
cold-blooded.
You know, just to call somebody a killer might pass, but when you're sitting there, exactly like you said, it's mischaracterizing and it's inflammatory. And, you know, I mean, when you get to the point of calling somebody a cold-blood killer and there's no facts that freaking present that in any of the evidence, then, yeah, there was a lot. I mean, I think the defense attorneys did very, very well in keeping that monster that I call him a monster, Welchel, in order, because he's got a reputation for being a beast. And so they did really good at making sure that they had their, you know, any kind of error that might need to be preserved, you know, to defend their client's rights on appeal. They did really good, but man, it was just constantly and repetitive, you know, things like going on that, you know, really the judge should have freaking had a break and pulled them into the chambers and said, hey, y'all need to lean back. Y'all are freaking badgering witnesses and, you know, all of the defense witnesses. I was really disturbed by the way that they disparaged and condescended and you know, pretty much gaslighted every one of the defense witnesses when they cross-examined. It was bad.
I think I was surprised when Welchel was told that he had a few minutes left. I think the judge cued him at about 2-minute mark. And so when he kept talking after that was up, the judge told him, your time is up. And he says, give me a few – I forgot how he worded it, but he was like, you know, dude, I ain't through talking. That was the tone. That wasn't the way he worded it, but that was the tone, like, I ain't finished talking. Give me a minute, I'll finish. And I thought, I've never seen that done before, because typically when the judge says your time is up, the person moves on. But I was just so surprised that that wasn't the case. So, yeah. We saw who was really running the courtroom. It seemed like Welchel was running the courtroom. And so I think Welchel, in my opinion, his reputation, y'all, and I'm just going to put it out there, Welchel is out of Paris, Texas. And I've done a couple of shows in Paris to the point that I'm scared to go down there when they're seeing. He's from Paris, and he used to be a prosecutor in Lamar County, which is in Paris. And that said, he did a case of Thomas Brunch, who is a man who killed his daughter's boyfriend. And Welchel prosecuted that trial, and he gave that man probation. And then we know the Affluenza kid, known as Ethan Couch. Ethan Couch killed 4 people and injured 9 others. And we all know Ethan got probation. We also know there was a case of a Jeffrey Holland. Jeffrey Holland was driving down I-30 near Beach in Fort Worth and struck and killed Ladrika Wagner and kept going. And the impact was so hard that it knocked the roof off of his truck. And so he continued on home because he'd been drinking. I'm sure he knew he was in trouble because he had been at a bar, him and his friend. And so they knew probably if the police came, he was going to get in a lot of trouble. But some kind of way they were able, I think they said a police officer, some kind of way saw a truck with no top on it and took the license plate down. And that's how they were able to track him down the next day. They went to the house. He still smelled of alcohol. When they asked him had he been involved in an accident, he told them that he did recall hitting something, but he didn't know what it was, and that he went back to the scene, but he couldn't find anything. Go figure. That man got probation as well. All of these cases were prosecuted, the prosecutor was Welchel. So I just found it very strange that Welchel gave all 3 men probation, and they all happened to be white, but in the Timothy Simpkins case, he wanted to give him life. And so that just struck me as strange, you know, the disparity between all of those cases. And the only difference is that Timothy Simpkins was black. So,
even to contrast, the disparity goes even farther than the Simpson. You're talking about this 10-year probation, this thing, you know, where the defendant is white and maybe, you know, that he identifies with that, this, that, whatever, and the victim was black. Okay, so he identifies with that. But here's the thing. In all of – Welchel is the top, like I said, he's known as in the DA's office, Tarrant County DA's office, as the top gun. He handles a lot of the high-profile cases that come through the DA's office. And, you know, he's a big, overbearing, you know, Goliath kind of guy. And so what I've known in several of the cases, one of them was the Timothy Huff, and then you've got the Timothy Simpkins, and there's several other ones where he completely he's in charge of the prosecution. He overcharges it, he overcharges the crime, the offense, you know, to where, you know, some of the things, this, that, whatever, and these when the defendant is black, he does everything in everything that he can to aggressively and zealously get every single enhancement. That means, you know, and every single benefit. You've seen it in The Simpsons. He objected to the self-defense instruction, and the self-defense, that's an issue that we can talk about with the attorney, but that's the contrast that I'm talking about. Is in the Timothy Huff case, you got the law, every single enhancement that he could seem to bring up to max out this person. If he can get him to the chair, you know, to the death chamber, that's what he's trying to do when there's black defendants. But then here you have this, like you were pointing out, the disparity is when it's, you know, somebody white that he's all about let's just downgrade this. Let's just, you know, let's be peaceful with this, you know.
Well, let's let Attorney Reed chime in. Good evening, Attorney Reed. How are you?
Good evening.
Good evening. Listen, you the man. You are the man. We want to know. We want to know a lot of stuff, and we want you to kind of fill us in. I think what we saw first thing, we saw them change the charge and add charges in the middle of the trial. Is that typical?
When you say middle of the trial, that you can't add charges in the middle of a trial, you can, because the defense has 10 days, by law, 10 days notice if they change the charging instrument. That is, if they change the formal charge, I have to have an opportunity to be put on notice as to what the charge is, and I have to have an opportunity to prepare for that charge. However, the law does recognize lesser included offenses, meaning that if the higher charge has the same elements below it, well, then you're already on notice. For example, if I charge you with theft, $2,500 to $20,000, a lesser included is theft $750 to $2,500, because the elements are there, just the amount changed. And so sometimes, if you're speaking in terms of when you go to add a lesser included offense at the end, that can be strategic on the defense's part, or that could be strategic on the state's part if they are in a trial and they believe, oh, shoot, we may not get to the higher charge that we wanted, but let's add this one lower charge in there so we can try to at least get that to give the jury something to think about in those terms. So, but you can't just kind of – you can't change the charge mid-trial because the defense has – to have an opportunity by law at minimum 10 days to notice before going to trial. So that's that aspect of it. I hope I didn't
no.
Over-explain that to you.
No, you did well. So how do we get to the point that you can get beat up twice by someone, but you can't use self-defense as a reason why you shot them?
Well, the laws regarding self-defense may seem plain on its face to you and I outside of a courtroom. Inside of a courtroom, things change. The law says that you can use that force which is necessary to end the encounter. Now, so sometimes when people turn away, then you can argue that the encounter was over with. They turned away. You know, they were done. Mm-hmm. They were going away. Okay? But there are circumstances on the flip side where you can say, and you've seen it, I've seen it, where, shoot, somebody could just be taking a rest. You know, so I've been in a fight with you. You know, I let you up. I turn. I take 6-7 steps away. I look back over my shoulder. I see you getting up again. I run back and I kick you. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
So now
mm-hmm.
you say, hey, just because he walked away doesn't mean that the encounter was necessarily over with. They were still in close enough proximity to me to potentially harm me.
Mm-hmm.
Are you following me?
Mm-hmm.
But,
oh, that's good. Yes.
And so, but if you, if somebody runs from you, okay, if they're and a lot of times, because it depends on where you're running to. When we have these conversations in my neighborhood, in my community, you know, if somebody tells you in a fight or a situation where you know that they have a bad reputation or a reputation for having a short temper, if somebody tells you something mm-hmm. like, "Okay, stay right there,"
yeah,
that is a threat.
Yeah.
That means I'm going to get something, because mm-hmm. I wouldn't tell you to stay right there if I had everything I needed right then and right there. Are you with me?
Yeah.
So if somebody tells you stay right there, or okay, I'll be right back, or I tell you what, let me get to my car. Well, bruh, you might have just did yourself in mm-hmm. my neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to be able to articulate that to a jury that, no, that was a definitive, definite threat, that if I let this person get to their car or something like that, that my life is in danger, and I don't have to wait for that person to shoot at me in a situation like that where I believe that that deadly force may be necessary. I just better be in a place where I can explain it to a jury, and I have jurors who would understand. Are you following me?
I do.
Because
you know,
if you have jurors who won't understand, then then you know what happens in downtown Harlem may not be a crime, but in the middle of a Kansas, it may very well be. Are you following me on that? If you know, it's just the cultures are different, and you have to be able to communicate that to a jury.
So just like in a crime of passion, if a man walks in and he catches his wife, you know, in a compromising position with another man, he could then take his gun and shoot her, or shoot either of them, or both of them, because they say it's a crime of passion. I can't understand how, if you can have emotions running that high, where you would kill a person in that situation, that your emotions couldn't be running and adrenaline couldn't be rushing the same way if someone had just beat you up and this had happened before with their brother, where you wouldn't be so afraid that you say, okay, this ain't going to happen a third time. I got to remove the threat so that, that they don't kill me.
Well,
that would be my concept.
So the way that they, the code, when you start speaking in terms of passion, I believe in the Texas Penal Code, it says sudden passion. So that's something like in the moment, whereas if I wake you up and you're having a nightmare, something bad just happened to you, or you have PTSD and I see you shaking or something and I wake you up and I wake you up too rough, you know, there's that moment in between when your mind is transitioning from that sleep state to being woke, wide awake, where there's a disconnect. And if in that moment, you know, that's where a lot of things can happen, depending on what I'm dreaming about and depending on what just happened. If I wake up and in that moment I think you're a burglar or something, or we're doing something to me, and I lash out with something that I had near me, or I shoot you or something, and then I wake up and realize, oh, shoot, this is scary. You know, that's different. If I step in the room, I already have a gun on me because I carry a gun or something like that, and I see that act taking place right then. And in that moment, and the first thing I do is I shoot. You have a better chance of getting a sudden passion than I'm about to go downstairs, get my gun, and go back upstairs. Now I'm processing. Are you following me? So
right.
Law lives in the subtleties. It lives in the cracks and the crevices and the nuances of words. It lives in every individual fact pattern, and it's up to attorneys to try to get jurors on their panel that they can communicate with. My goal when I go to trial, I got to find somebody I can talk to. I got to find somebody who I can make stuff plain to, and they'll say, I understand exactly where you're coming from. And the problem is, too many of us, one, we're already outnumbered statistically by populace. We are a minority. We're you know, in the high teens of the population, so therefore the jury pools are already not going to have a whole lot of us. And then when the first thing, you know, when you get folk that you can communicate with on the jury, the first thing they try to do is run off. You understand? Well, now you're decreasing the likelihood or the probability of having someone who will understand your position, because everybody is the culmination of their life's experiences. Your life has painted your views on America. My life as a black male from Como is different from a brother who's from the South Side, although we have a lot of similarities. But that same brother from Utah, shoot, his experiences, although a lot of them may be the same, maybe are still going to be unique to him.
But I got to find people, and that's the hard part. I got to find people. I need people that I can communicate with who can understand, you know. Now, particular to this verdict and so forth, this it creates an interesting legal situation because there are things that I believe are appealable. Now, every time you appeal something doesn't mean you're going to win. You know, you try to preserve what you believe is error so that the appellate court will have an opportunity to hear it. If you don't raise that issue at trial, the appellate court's going to tell you you didn't raise that issue at trial. You can't raise it now. There are only certain limited issues that you can raise for the first time on appeal, and most of those are constitutional. But evidentiary stuff, you have to raise it at trial. Otherwise, you waive the right to appeal. So a lot of times in trial, you'll hear some stuff that's really mundane or really lawyerish. And at that point, I'm not even talking to this judge. I'm talking to the appellate court that may have to review this, such as self-defense wasn't put in the charge. That's an issue. It can be argued that the judge overstepped his bounds. The law says if there's some evidence that if self-defense gets raised and there's some evidence to support it, then it should be in front of a jury. Other people will argue that self-defense can only be brought out by the defendant himself. I don't believe that's the law. So what do? You appeal it. But here's the when I say this brings an interesting thing up. On attempted capital murder, you could have caught a letter. And as a defense attorney, you never want to mess around with letters on verdicts. Okay, because there's that L at the end of something is something you want to stay away from. So when you're looking at the fact that there are a lot of numbers, 87, between 12 and 99, that if you were to win your appeal and the court were to overturn the conviction, you get to start over, okay? You get self-defense put in there, but a second jury convicts you. When you had 12 in the bank, that second jury could come back and give you 50, 60 life. You understand? Because you're dealing with a whole different set of people, and you don't know what that second set of people are going to think. So that is a big risk that all clients would then have to consider. Because technically, based on my experience, this is what we call a 3G offense, an aggravated offense. You know, if you only have to do half of the sentence, that means this young man could be home in 6 years on parole. Okay, if you mess around and I don't want to say mess around, if he appeals, wins his appeal, gets a new trial, there every trial is its own animal. He could get convicted the second time again. And if you get 20 years, you just added 8 more years in prison onto your life. He gets 30 or own up. Are you understanding what I'm saying? So the jury here, they gave him, when I argue in front of juries, and I get to the point where if I'm in punishment, I let them know that justice is a range. It is not a finite thing. You can have situations where you need and where the situation calls for high-end justice. But you also can have situations where the facts call for low-end justice, okay? Because if you cannot consider the full punishment range, then you get excluded by law as a juror. So there are some situations where somebody could be convicted of capital murder, attempted capital murder, you know, whatever the situation may be, where you might give them the minimum, 5 years. Or, but you also have to be able to give them the maximum. So in this situation, the jury gave him what they considered low-end justice. They had to, we convicted him, okay? They recognized he's young. They took into consideration the facts, and they gave him, I guarantee you, what the state is going to say is an absolutely low sentence. And when you look at the fact that you can go from 5 to 99, and they only went 7 years above the, yes, that's low-end justice. And so you will be rolling the dice should you appeal and win and have another trial, because you could mess around, get convicted, and have a higher sentence. Now, I don't. When I say that, I'm not talking to the family. I'm not talking to him. I'm talking to, I'm speaking in terms of the law and how things could end up playing out in court. In court, this is the kind of decision making that involves real consequences. So, you know, those. So that's when I say this is, they created an interesting situation. If the jury had given him 60 years, everybody goes, shoot, you appeal that automatically. You know, hell, you gave him 60 years. But if they came back and they gave him the minimum, they gave him 5, bruh, you might want to hold your mute.
Yeah.
Are you following me?
Mm-hmm.
So I hope I'm articulating this so that you understand what I'm saying and that you see the dynamic that is now in place in recognizing the jury considered the situation and they found some level of sympathy for him in that they only sentenced him to 12.
Mm-hmm.
So here's a question I have, though, because I don't know if I missed it. I don't think I missed it because I was watching pretty tight. The understanding that I have is that the attempted capital murder only came into play because it was the launch pad for that was the terroristic threat. I didn't hear the verdict on the terroristic threat count whenever they came in, because basically that's what they were using to justify the capital murder over aggravated assault, basically. And that sort of goes into play with the self-defense justification too. I think that was this judge, in my opinion, I mean, I'm not knocking him down, but the learning curve way behind, I mean, the experience level and this and that, whatever, because I think he was overwhelmed with this case. But the thing that I'm saying is if you're committing a crime, like if you're robbing somebody and, you know, this same scenario happens and you shoot them, then that would take self-defense justification out of play in a lot of ways too, you know. And I think that's the dynamic that the judge is tweaking on.
To an extent. So let me break down a little bit of the question or what that's messing with you a little bit. When you have another offense that's incorporated into a higher level offense, I don't have to charge you separately in that charging instrument, because in the charging instrument, it's going to say, in order to get to this, you must believe that this offense occurred. I don't have to charge you with it. You have to believe that those elements have been met for that offense. Okay? And so if the jury charge, the elements for that terroristic threat would have been in that jury charge, and the jury said, yeah, I believe he met these elements, therefore now I can consider attempted capital, okay? But I don't have to charge you directly with the terroristic threat. Are you
right?
Does that go to kind of on that?
Working around what you were talking about, the other question that I would want to ask, working around what you were talking about earlier about balancing whether you should appeal or not, I understand that on the self-defense, on these errors and everything. However, I think just in my pro se novice point of view, the sufficiency of evidence on that terroristic threat element might be in play. And I'm thinking, I might be wrong, but I'm thinking if you get most of the time, if you get an insufficient evidence, I mean, there's a little play.
That is a rarity. Appellate courts do not like taking the place of jurors because they'll say that juror had the opportunity to sit down and read out the character, the characteristics of each and every witness. That juror saw them walk down that aisle. That juror saw them look over at somebody. That they could see, that juror could see that they were tapping their hand off to the side.
Right.
The juror could see that they were sweating. The juror could see that they had shifty eyes. All of these things that come into play when you're communicating that you're not going to get across on paper. As I'm communicating to you by phone, it has way more effect with you hearing my voice than if I'm typing you text messages that I have to add emojis and stuff to. Further, if you see me talking to you, you'll see my body movements, my hands moving, my eyes bucking, you know. So being there in the courtroom always supersedes I'm reading a court transcript. And so appellate courts don't like really messing with sufficiency of the evidence. If a jury took time out of their lives, sat there in trial, sat in front of all or had all of the witnesses sit in front of them, and the jury made a decision based on the evidence as presented. However, an appellate court has no problem stepping in on a constitutional issue or an error that was material, basically meaning the jury either saw some evidence that they should not have seen that was material to them making a decision, or the jury was not allowed to see some evidence that they should have been allowed to see that prohibited them from making a decision. You following me?
Yeah.
And I don't remember. I don't remember if she specifically argued that in her motion for a directed verdict either. I didn't hear terroristic threat. I don't know.
Hey, I'm trying to read this, Adrian. A quick question: Could you break down the understanding of what it means when they say jury of your peers? You know, we hear that term so often, but
okay. All crimes, I'll start from this level. Texas is its own separate sovereign, meaning that Texas has its own penal code separate from the U.S. or the federal crimes. You got federal crimes, you have state crimes, and then you have municipal ordinances that are all underneath the entity that's sitting right over them. But Texas has the Texas Penal Code. Now, so that means any offense committed in Texas, if the Texas Penal Code says it's a crime, you can be prosecuted under the Texas Penal Code. Now, Texas has 254 counties. In these 254 counties, the state has broken down these 254 counties to various districts. Most of the districts are by counties. In the heavily populated places, but in the lesser populated places, there may be three counties to a district. So these counties, these districts, form your peer group because that's where your local community lives. So I'm gonna come back to that word local here in just a second. So citizens of Tarrant County, because Tarrant County is this district, the group of your peers means the people who live in Tarrant County. Tarrant County is the neighborhood. And so you pull from the neighborhood. But my position, so sometimes you know, if you look at data and you see, hey, in the state of Texas, for this offense, 99.9% of the state would give this gave this person this sentence, but down here in this little piece of Texas, they're given an outlier sentence. You know, their sentence is way longer. Well, arguably, the state of Texas, we're under the Texas Penal Code and the Texas justice system, and when we say cruel and unusual, okay, well, that blip in that one county is certainly unusual. So arguably, you look at Texas in that situation as the greater community, because aside from Arkansas, Oklahoma, Kansas, wherever else, Texas is the penal code in the community. We shouldn't have that outlier offense, but your peer group in terms of criminal trials and civil trials is the district in which you live. Now, going back to what I said earlier, where are voter rolls generated from? They're generated from driver's licenses, voter registration cards, you know, and so one level will say, okay, this person is a registered voter. That means they're of age and they meet a certain set of minimum criteria. That computer then sends that to the Tarrant County computers. The Tarrant County computers or something, you know, may run a second check, and it may weed out some people based on, they may be a certain age, this or that. Then you get into a jury panel where you're down at the courthouse, and your panel is there that a computer has generated, but now you got to start asking questions, you know, because it may not know that you have a criminal record or that you are a convicted felon or something like that, and that's where you find that out, and your jury pool gets whittled down even more. But a jury of your peers means basically somebody from your neighborhood, and for when it comes to courts, the district becomes your neighborhood. That's your peer group. Now, if you want to increase the odds of having more people that you can relate to, then you got to have people registering to vote and meeting all the other eligibility criteria. That means not being a felon, speaking English, you know, so on and so forth. Hopefully that addresses your question. If not, you know, rephrase it. I'll do like I do my clients. Just rephrase it or re-ask, and I'll try to give you a different one.
The one big problem that I see in this one is not so I'm not going to get into the fact of the we're only two blacks. The big thing that I see going on here, especially with the theme of the trial, you know, there was a lot of talk about this generation, and my understanding is that everybody in that that the youngest juror was mid-30s, and here you have a 19, 20-year-old kid, you know, here you have a 19-year-old kid getting judged by gray-headed and bald-headed folkies, you know.
And that's where, again, when you go into a trial, studies have shown and in prosecutor and defense attorney boot camps, it's people like themes that they can follow. If you remember the movie Amistad, he's like, tell the story. You know, even in board meetings, tell people stories. If you just give them numbers and stats, but if you give them a compelling story, something that they can hold on to, give them a jingle. If the glove don't fit, you know, Everybody knows the next three words. You give somebody a jingle, and when they go back there, they'll remember that jingle. You know, I don't want to grow up. Everybody knows the next set of words. You know, I'm a Toys R Us kid. And so when you develop your theme based on the facts, by the time I get to the opening statement, you know, I have to ride with my theme, because that's what I'm telling you. Here's what's going to happen here. But if you notice, they didn't do an opening statement here. So they kind of let me take a look at where this is going, and then I will adjust to that, because that's a strategy in and of itself, okay? So when you say this generation, and you, that's your theme and that's what you've been developing towards the whole time period that you're the attorney and you're in your war room and you're scribbling on your board and you're reading your case law, and lo and behold, you look up and your jury panel is a bunch of white-haired folk, as you say. Well,
yeah.
The jury panel is the jury panel. You just try to get the best people from the jury panel that you can,
yeah,
at that point, and that's where you start parsing up the jury questionnaires and trying to have a strategy on, you know, do I want somebody that watches CSI? Do I want somebody,
yeah,
who watches, you know, freaking Fox News, or do I want somebody that watches CNN? Do I want somebody, you know, sometimes you may want that Fox guy because those folk are, you know, crazy or skeptical of everything, and maybe I want them to be skeptical of the government in my case. Are you following me? So,
yeah,
there's a lot that goes into trial strategy, and but when we're all standing there and we get that stack of jury questionnaires and we're reading through all of them, but we don't see who those jurors are until they walk into that room, and I guarantee, you know, we're looking for certain types and they're looking for certain types, and we're all trying to figure out, oh shoot, you know, we may have a oh shoot moment where, you know, and like, ah shoot, this, we ain't got nobody that we can talk to. Or the people that we can talk to are in the back. They're numbered because the jurors are numbered. For those who are listening, jurors get numbered one through whatever. And the way you get selected to a jury is by deselection. And what I mean by that, the first 12 people who do not get struck become the jury.
Yeah.
And so if I strike juror number 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9, then now juror 2, 4, 6, 8, you know, are all on the jury unless the other side strikes them. So if the other side strikes 2, 4, and 6, now juror number, 10 or 11 is the first person on the jury. And so you get selected to a jury by not getting cut. Okay, so how do you not get cut? Well, sometimes we try to argue people, get people cut because they're just not a suitable juror for that particular offense. If this is a sexual assault case and you've been sexually assaulted, this ain't your show because you're going to bring a bias to this panel.
Yeah.
So, you know, all jurors are not one size fits all.
Yeah.
And
they
just
anyway,
go
ahead.
Problems late.
Let me ask a question.
They've been having a lot. Go ahead.
Where does stand your ground come into play? We are in Texas, where stand your ground, and it, you know, is a self-defense law, and everybody in Texas has a gun. But where does it come into play when you're in the situation of a Timothy Simpkins, or you've been pistol whipped in one situation, you're jumped on in the classroom, you fear for your life? Does stand your ground not have any relevance in this particular case?
Let me explain that to you with an example. Let's say this guy has beaten you up 5 times and taken your lunch money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Well, the 6th time, you shoot him.
Mm-hmm.
You might be in trouble because now there's an establishment that on the first preceding 5 times, all you did was got your butt whooped. There was no threat of you being killed. Are you following me on this? So now I can say, hey, you didn't die the other 5 times. In fact, you weren't even seriously injured other than your pride. You know, you got your lunch money took, caught a black eye, that healed. I can't even tell you got that right now. You know, so... So, but in this instance, you brought out a gun.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you changed the facts a little.
Mm-hmm.
This person is known to carry a gun. You've seen them with a gun. They've flashed a gun at you before when they beat you up. On one of the occasions, you know, he put the gun to your head and said, I ought to squeeze off on you right now. Okay, mm-hmm. Now we got a different set of facts. That's why I say everything is fact-tendent when it comes to that self-defense situation. Now, in your home, you do not have a duty to retreat at your residence on your property. Generally, in public, you can only use enough force to end the threat, whether it's fist on fist. You know, if you whooping me up and I display a firearm, I'm like, okay, that's it. Now I'm so tired that if I let you knock me out, I'm totally at your mercy, and I don't know what you're going to do to me. If you knock me out, I can't afford to let you knock me out. Now I'm going to let you know, bruh, I have a gun. Now I'm getting to the point where my life, I believe, my life is on the line. And the thing is, you better be able to articulate that to a jury that will understand where you were in that moment. Because one jury may, the next jury may not. That's the subtlety of law. That's why law is called a practice. You practice medicine. You practice law, because what works on carry, the dosage that works on you, may not be the dosage that works on me. You may be allergic to poison ivy. I may not. And in law, you apply the specific facts of an individual case to the law, and you better hope you get jurors that you can communicate with that can see things your way and say, in that situation, that's not a crime. Going back to a time to kill. We all know Samuel Jackson shot that guy who raped his daughter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That was not passion. He planned that. He took that gun down. You understand? But at the end of the movie, the jury came up with the old some people need to be killed situation. I understand why he did it. We're not finding him guilty.
Nullification.
But he actually committed murder. He planned it. He shot the guy. Are you following? So that's why law is a practice. It all depends on who's in that jury box on that day and time.
Let me ask you then, as I say, we'll rephrase the question. I understand that Timothy Simpkins' father is deceased, and he had been beaten to death. To me, which is something that I, and I'm not an attorney, I'll be the first to admit, but I think I would have made that point in the trial, that this young man has lived with that knowledge his entire life, and the fact that, you know, he's now being beaten by these people on one, now two occasions, and thinking about that situation with his father would be a very good reason then to say, I can't allow this to happen to me, therefore removing the threat.
The thing is, some trials can be dictated by funding. Some trial strategies, you say, a judge may say, you know, you'd have to show why that's relevant and pertinent to the jury. The other side is going to say, judge, you know, we don't think that's relevant. So they object to it, and whether or not it came in, because some standards are the what would a reasonably prudent person do, and some standards are subjective. What would you do in that situation? And so you have to go out, because if your client isn't testifying at trial, and I'm not putting an 18, 19-year-old kid up there against those two well-trained state prosecutors. Roseanne and Lloyd been there for a minute. They didn't put the Rudy Poots up there. Okay? And I'm not finna put some kid up there fresh out of high school, didn't even finish high school, you know, mm-hmm. against those two skilled attorneys to tell that tale. So he said, okay, well, let me go hire some experts, and maybe I can have the experts come. Well, guess what? Experts cost money, you know, $300-$500 an hour, fly down, sit down, do this. So some stuff can be have monetary constraints, and some stuff, you know, it's easy to the Monday morning quarterback situations. But like I said, the jury gave him 12 years. That mm-hmm. is low-end justice. So this defense yeah. team did something right, and the jury may have said, we, you know, the Chris Rock, I don't condone it, but I understand, but I can't let you just, you know, go up to, you know, yeah. the school, shoot, you know, shoot some folk, you know, and whether you meant to do it or not, that's a, you know, a whole different animal, but some folk got shot. What about they judges? You know, I got yeah. shot. I still got a bullet in me. What about my, you know, so they say, okay, we're going to convict you, but we ain't going to throw you away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the conversation in the jury room.
Mm-hmm.
I would go back, and I understand everything. You're exactly right. You know, we talk about accountability, and we have to have, you know, justice has to have a dimension of accountability for everything, or it's just, it becomes an irrelevant component of society. But the problem, here's where I am, not so much is what can an appeal do, or how can we change the verdict, or this, that, whatever. But here's the thing that I have, and it's two bad faith things. Back to what you was talking about, the self-defense justification thing, the disparity here, because, and I bring up, we don't have to get into a long discussion about it, but the variance between what we saw coming out of Lloyd Welchel about this making sure that self-defense didn't come into play. But, however, in the case of Aaron Dean, where there was a Fourth Amendment. Carol Darch pulled her gun during a Fourth Amendment, you know, unwarrantless Fourth Amendment intrusion into the backyard, holding her gun out. And so right then and there, that disqualifies that was a provocation, and that disqualifies their eligibility, in my view, it was just wrong that he, you know, here you are, Aaron Dean, he gets the self-defense justification instruction. But in this case, they don't do it. And I've been reviewing cases today, and I've seen it over and over. That self-defense justification is a very low threshold to get that in there. And I don't know why they didn't do it, because it's usually disregarded.
That is, as I said from the top, the law only requires some evidence, but some yeah. judges have to have believed that self-defense can only be claimed by the person, and so your client has to testify. Some judges believe that, but that is not. I don't believe that's the state of the law, but the judge could be right, but the judge could be wrong. And in this situation, that's where we have the interesting situation, because he did get a low sentence, and it's yeah. like, do I really want to run the risk of appealing? Or do I just want to be able to, in 6 years, come home and start as afresh and anew and live the rest yeah. of my life free? And that's where you get the interesting situation. I concede that there are issues, yeah. and I think that they were well preserved. And if the kid would have got sentenced to 70 years, we'd be yeah. having a different conversation on that level. You know, and so, but now it's interesting, because the jury gave him low-end justice, which he wouldn't necessarily be guaranteed to get the next time around if the next jury found him guilty. And if it went back to that court, the judge may read some case law in the meantime, or talk to a senior judge, or, you know, a more experienced judge, and a more experienced judge will be like, look, if they send this back, well, the appellate court may say you did it wrong and send it back.
Yeah.
And the judge, hey, I freaked it up. You know, here we are again, wasting taxpayers' money. We had to do it twice because I messed up. You understand?
Yeah.
No judge likes to be overturned on appeal, but the jury – in giving the what I consider low-end justice, they thought about it. They thought about some of the arguments that were made. They gave him credit for a lot of the situations, you know, that took place with multiple people being shot and this and that, and they only gave him 12 years. They thought about some stuff. So for the attorneys, they may not hear it, but every defense attorney across this country is going to say the defense won. There are ways that you can win cases. You can win outright with not guilties, or you can beat punishments. If the state was offering 50 years and I got you 12, we won.
Right.
And I agree. I would say, go ahead.
The question, can a prosecutor get up there and knowingly say something that's not true? Because I heard Salinas.
No attorney can. That's unethical. No
that's
attorney
unethical.
Can. You
okay,
cannot
so,
say something that you know to be untrue, nor can you allow a witness that you know is lying to testify. If a witness lies while on the stand and you know that they lied, you're obligated to inform the judge, you know, judge, they just told me something totally different. They ain't going to do it in front of the jury. You'd send the jury out, but you'd let the judge know, judge, I believe my client just lied on the stand. But we have ethical rules and ethical obligations that are in place to prohibit that type of conduct. So go ahead.
Well, no, Prosecutor Salinas twice called Timothy Simpkins a killer, a cold-blooded killer. And I said, well, who did he kill? But I didn't hear any objections, so I was like, did they fall asleep over there? Because I would have been jumping up and down. Who did he kill? And the judge never said anything.
Okay, so that, you know, arguably, that's an opinion.
Inflammatory.
Okay, but so if I run through a mall with an AR and I just randomly shoot as many folk as I can, and I do it calmly, and it just so happens that none of them died, a lot of folk will say that dude is a killer. He was trying to kill, but it just so happened that the Lord said, I'm gonna let you live. But he shot 15 people walking around a mall. That is arguably an opinion. Now it is different to say this man murdered this many people when nobody died. But to say someone is a killer, they have the mentality of a killer, that's just like saying my pizza is the best.
But for me to say Attorney Reed has the potential to be a killer. I mean, just look at his actions. But to me, that's different than saying Attorney Reed is a killer.
In that moment, you could object, hey, judge, ain't nobody in here being killed. I said, well, he sure shot a bunch of folk, and it's by the grace of God. One of them was a quarter inch from the aorta. So, you know, a judge could sustain it. A judge could overrule it and say keep it pushing. Is it going to be an issue on appeal that an appellate court is going to deal with? The answer to that is probably not. They're probably going to say that is not material to the verdict, given the large amount of evidence that they gave. The jury had 99 other things to consider. Just, you know, because she said he's a killer, may not be one. Again, may. And if you don't object, you don't save it, and it doesn't become an issue. And so that will not be an issue that to be heard on appeal. A lot of times when we're in trial, I'm going to tell you this about being in trial. And it is a heavy burden to bear to have somebody else's life in your hands. I can't tell you how hard it is to be at a TCU game on Saturday, but the whole time I'm at the game, I'm wondering if my dude finna get 40 on Monday. I'm not there actually enjoying the moment. I'm constantly in a final. I go to sleep thinking. I wake up like, ooh, I can do this. That tells me I was thinking while I was asleep, so I wasn't getting meaningful rest. It's a heavy burden to have some, you know, physically, mentally, it drains you. It comes with a toll. And so in the moment, in a trial, you got so many thought processes going on. Sometimes you miss stuff. And they'll tell you in courtroom tactics boot camps, don't get so caught up that you missed the part where the witness said he didn't do it or something. And you just, or you saw an opening, there was an opening that came and you totally missed it because you were focusing on this or that. So we miss stuff sometimes, and that's why you have a trial partner or sort of team that hopefully somebody catches it. Or if the three of you kind of look at each other like, I ain't worried about that, you know, it's just, you got bigger fish to fry. So sometimes you do miss stuff. It's hard. It's hard to hear that my client could have got, 99 years. The state offered him 30. The jury still convicted him of, and gave him 15. The defense attorney is going to say, we won, but the person going to prison ain't going to think so.
And I think you were speaking to how, as an outsider of the courtroom, and I would go ahead and celebrate his defense team, because I think some of the stuff that Kerry's saying, we understand it's a good conversation to have on technical matters. You know, there's some discussion to have there. But I think what you said earlier about being in that courtroom and having the vibe, I think his, you know, a lot of the stuff, I think it was a strategic thing, because knowing, like we talked about Lloyd Welchel's, his Goliath, I had a problem watching from the outside that the prosecution seemed to stomp and wipe their feet off on all the defense witnesses, you know, and that was just so hyperbolic. And I can sit here and see the two things that I think that saved him was, I think that the vibe was for the defense team that they knew they had a sympathetic jury on the low end justice level. So I think they calculated that, and they just let him kind of dig his own grave on that. And then the other point, the last point I'll make, I think that what really knocked the ball out of the park to get him the low end sentence was Lisa Pamplin's shot over the bow reference about the affluenza kid, she put that into play, and so that I like that move.
That could be totally relevant. Well, go ahead. And Kerry, I got to get back into church here. I see vacation Bible schools, and I got to go and start locking some stuff up. But go ahead real quick.
No. I'm good. Thank you so much, Attorney Reach, for chiming in. Tell them if they need a defense attorney how to reach you.
That's simple. My number is two numbers and a name. 737 Leon. 7-3, if you forget the third number, go back to the 7. 737 Leon will ring my phone and call with some money. No, just kidding.
Thank you, Leon.
But
thank
I'm
you
not.
So much.
All right. Bless y'all. And I hope that I was able to add something to the show, and we appreciate what you do, Kerry. Thank you.
Thank you. Y'all, that was Attorney Leon Reeves. He told y'all how to reach him, and if you forgot what he said, go back and listen again, and you'll have it. No, to clarify something, Chris, you made it sound like I have a problem with the defense team. I don't have a problem with the defense team. We're just basically behind the scenes talking about what happened at the trial. I am not, like, beating up on the defense team at all.
No, that's not what I was saying. I was just saying that I was just pointing out, I'm understanding Leon tuned us in there. You know, we're kind of like asking these questions and everything, and from where we see it, we can criticize the defense team because we don't have the vibe that they have. We don't have the.
No,
I know
you're
not.
No. We can't.
Don't do that. No. Let me be clear. I know Mark Clayton from Facebook, and I think she's a dynamic attorney. I don't know Lisa Tamplin, but I've seen her on TV a lot recently doing some big things as far as these cases are concerned. So I'm not here criticizing anybody. That's not it. We're talking about, unless somebody forgot the intro of the show, we're just doing behind the scenes talking about what happened at the trial. So, yeah. No, please don't put that out there. That's the wrong energy, because that's never. I don't know if you heard me a couple of shows back, but I do not do stuff like that. I mean, no. They did a phenomenal job. The young man got 12 years. I mean, when he was facing life. So that's not anything that I said in the pre-show meeting we had, and that's not anything that I'm having now. So
putting that on you at all. I wasn't putting that on you at all. So.
But that's the way it came off. And I'm like, okay. Wait, yeah, don't do that, because that's not me. Because a lot of people, you know, were chiming in on things that they saw that went on at the trial. That's all we're doing is basic. We're talk show, y'all. That's what we do. We talk. And so we're just talking about the show. We're talking about the trial, what happened at the trial, that type of thing. And so, no. We talked about the prosecution. We talked about the witnesses. No. So it's over. Let's just say that. The trial is over. Where they go from here is up to the family, is up to the attorney. Period.
Right.
But in terms of what we're doing tonight, we're just talking about what happened. You know, so anything, y'all, FYI, for anybody that's not clear, it's a talk show. That's what we do. We talk about what everybody else is talking about. And so tonight we're just talking about what we saw in the trial. You know, the witnesses, the prosecution, the defense, Timothy. In fact, I'd like to go there tonight. Timothy is a young man. I think they said he's 20 now. I thought Timothy did a phenomenal job not letting them rattle him enough that he got emotional up there. I thought he was very level-headed. He did not rush to answer the questions. He seemed like he was thinking before he spoke. You know, some of the questions were really hard, but the young man still held his own at 20 years old. So somebody's texting me, y'all.
No, I'm not
there. Oh, I'm sorry. He's 19. That's why I'm sorry. He's 19. I said, his family just texted me. He's 19, not 20.
Jerry, not only did he hold his own on the stand, but he held his own in front of the world. You know what I'm saying? Because the world was watching. You can say the world. You know what I mean? The world by America, whatever. Blah blah blah. Because it's, you know, it's national. So yeah, I think he did. And then nobody can say that there wasn't a sense of, because they try to make it like, they try to make him into, you know, for, you know, they were vilifying him, they try to make it as if he wasn't remorseful, but he really was. You know what I'm saying? And only he was remorseful, and he, the reality of what it was, it really hit, you know. And then he stated that he's been dealing with it, you know. He stated that he's still dealing with the after effects of that, you know, all of that, which occurs, you know. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, this whole thing, you got to realize, you know, to carry the burden of being in front of the world for 2 years on this whole thing, and everybody, you know, has their opinions about this and have their opinions about that. And then you got to sit there and be judged by people who don't even know you, you know, who, you know, think they know you just based on what they've seen on television or whatever. So was it hard? Okay. So somebody, by the way, I communicated with his mother earlier. And we talked about, and we really, y'all didn't give her much time. We talked about an hour's notice. It was about an hour's notice when I got her phone number. So I reached out to her. I was able to have a brief conversation with her. And she said that, you know, she didn't know if she would come on, that she could possibly have a family spokesperson come on. And so I think they decided that that's not a good idea, and that's okay. She said, did y'all talk about the original case? And they went up on his charges. That's what I told y'all. You know, they went, they changed the charges in the middle of the trial. No, we did not. And if you could clarify on what the original charge was versus what they went up to, I would appreciate it. No, that's what I was asking Attorney Rizzo. Huh?
I got it. They arrested him. They arrested him, and the original charges that they arrested him for and advocated publicly were unlawful carrying and aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. Three counts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
The unlawful carrying, and then, so what they, the unlawful carrying would not have triggered into the thing, and that's what I'm telling you, that's what we were trying to get into. The unlawful carrying would not have triggered into being relevant to prove the capital offense kind of aspect of the terroristic threat. So they enhanced, they used the terroristic threat, which was a long shot. The facts weren't there. He didn't sit there and communicate a threat to anybody until after he got his ass, you know, stomped in and then in sudden passion. And so that's what I was waiting to see play out throughout the whole trial, guilt, innocent, and whatever. I was trying to figure out why was it capital, why were they trying to go with capital murder? And at the very end, during the penalty phase, I found out why, and that was because they wanted to disqualify his eligibility for the sudden passion that would have degraded everything to a second-degree felony. See, those aggravated assault charges originally would have enhanced to first-degree felony under the facts. But with the sudden passion, they would, he would have got the sudden passion instruction if they charged that. If even if they had charged him with murder, he would have got the sudden and passion. But they forced the ball with the capital. They forced the ball with the capital murder charge so that they could eliminate the his eligibility for a sudden passion instruction during the penalty. They was trying to get him. They was trying to lynch him for life. You know.
Okay. What they just sent me was. Originally arrested on three aggravated assaults with a deadly weapon, filed and indicted three attempted murders. And then it says re-indicted on attempted capital murder, March of 2023. So I'll say this again. Originally arrested on three aggravated assaults with a deadly weapon, and then filed and indicted three attempted murders, and then re-indicted under attempted capital murder March of 2023. So that's where we are. And so, you know, it sounds like, you know, it really, I mean, this just typically doesn't happen like this. So it sounds like, I don't know if maybe they were, you know, getting people, I guess, statements or whatever, and that's how they were changing the charges, or if they, you know, some kind of way came across the tape from the gas station and they hadn't had the gas station tape before. But I think what I'm confused about is it doesn't seem like anyone was ever charged for what they did to him. He was charged with what he did to them in terms of shooting the young man and the teacher and the other student, and I think a pregnant lady fell in the middle of all the chaos. But in terms of anybody else being charged for pistol whipping him at the gas station or the, you know, the fight at the school where he never defended himself, it doesn't seem like that they ever charged the other people, which I don't know how fair that is in terms
of. They debunked the whole pregnant lady thing in the trial. That was not in play. I mean, that was something that was in the air during the trial. It was proven and disqualified, you know, so that's just – that's more hyperbolic shit that the DA tried to play.
Wow. Interesting. So they just made up victims in the situation that it didn't happen. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, y'all, the whole thing was caught on tape, you know, the fight in the school. And I just – you know, and I'm this type of person, y'all. I'm one of the nicest people you'll ever meet. I am. I just really am. But when you take me there, I can go from 0 to 80 for real. I mean, real fast, real quick. And so if you ever put your hands on me, it's, listen, I go somewhere else with you because I'm not ever the type of person, I'm not a physical person. But I can see in my own life, and then other people can decide for themselves what they would do. But in my own life, I'm just not the type of person that, you go ever, the lady was not pregnant. They're saying to me the lady was not even pregnant.
No.
Okay, so she wasn't even pregnant.
There was just endless instance of that kind of crap going on with the prosecutors.
Wow.
It wasn't
so
a good look
right
at all.
That part right there. And so, I just think in terms of, let's be fair, you don't put your hands on other people, because today people just don't, nobody's just going to allow you to just hit them. And the thing is, most people do know that if you let somebody who jumps on you leave, they're probably going to come back with something worse. And so, I don't know. The whole trial is just very, very odd in terms of the way things went down because you still got to consider the fact he had been jumped on twice. So he's got to think, okay, three times, no. Or what do they say? First time, shame on me. Second time, shame on you. Third time, that's insanity level right there to allow somebody to come back. And the third time, be able
right.
to, possibly do something worse. I don't know. I'm so glad, though.
Well, here
Huh?
Go ahead.
What'd you say, Pierre?
We got something on the horizon here next month, and I'm going to tell you, it's the same scenario we got going on, the same players. Lloyd Welchel, if you guys remember, there was a story a year or so ago at Arlington Lamar High School where a kid who claimed that he was being bullied and raped on campus by students, right? Well, he showed up to school.
We don't want to mix those two stories.
I'm not mixing them up. Okay. That's fine.
But I'm just saying for the audience that we don't want to mix up two school situations and people be confused as to what we're talking about. You see what I'm saying?
Let me finish it because it's important to say. Okay, so Lloyd Welchel is prosecuting this case. It was in Judge Kim's court. And Lloyd Welchel has been spending all of this time during pretrial trying to get him certified as an adult. Well, Judge Kim knocked that out of play, so he's going to be tried as a juvenile in Judge Kim's court next month, middle of next month. So that's a case to be watching if you guys want to see more of Lloyd Welchel's chicanery.
But the whole thing. Okay, you didn't tell us what race this child is.
I haven't been able to do. I'm just off the cuff saying I'm presuming he's black because that's what
yeah.
I wouldn't be trying
yeah,
to freaking get him
yeah.
as an adult. That's Lloyd Welchel's case. That's what Lloyd Welchel does.
Let's go make a presumption. Then it's not sure. Let's go. Just go do that.
Yeah.
Because I don't even think with a we won't get a chance to even you said it's gonna be tried in juvenile court. You have to go there to see that. We won't know. It won't be no cameras or nothing like that going on in juvenile court.
No problem.
Yeah,
not.
People can go.
Let me tell you a moment that stood out to me Friday, and I think everybody kind of got the last out of this one. The trial. We know the seriousness of the trial, but I forgot the gentleman's name, the brother's name, the neighbor. He was giving up, speaking on Timothy's behalf and their relationship, this, that, or the other. And then the lady, the prosecutor, she tried to take him somewhere when it came to the particular text messages. And he basically, he basically told her that's, What you're saying up there is not what it actually is. That's just urban. That's urban. You don't understand urban, and mm-hmm. everybody, the laughter that broke out. The laughter that broke out. I mean, that moment it just, and then how she just thought she was just this. She thought she was something. She literally just stopped what she doing and looked over, like.
You're talking about Salinas.
You know, talking about Salinas. She felt some type of way because everybody was laughing at her. You know, after he said, "No, that's urban talk. You don't understand it." Basically, so you don't understand it. That's urban talk.
Okay, I was just then, whoever y'all were talking about. His name is Jason, and she said she
Mr.
was not
Jason.
Pregnant.
Okay.
Okay, Jason. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, who is she referring to?
Who, me? Oh, she? No. I'm saying it. They said his name is Jason, the brother that was on the stand.
Okay. I'm assuming that. Okay, gotcha. Okay. Jason is the
name. So yeah. He's the neighbor. Yeah. So he was. You know, and he basically told. He's like. The way he said it, though, I guess that's so the laughter just broke out, and she thought she was, and I thought she was about to say something, you know. She just looks over, like one of those, like, what's up, like, but the judge kind of, he shut her down. She started mumbling something, but he shut her down real quick, but that was one of those moments that, yeah, she brought her back down to earth. That brought her back down to earth, you know. That's what I think. That's one of those bringing her back down to earth moments.
But wasn't Salinas saying something ugly to the family, to the Timken family?
He was at that moment she was about to mumble something. She didn't get it out. Whatever she was about to say, she didn't get a chance to verbalize it because the judge he immediately put a stop to it.
But that's what I was talking about generally. Go ahead.
Let me say this real quick. They're comparing this to like a mass school shooting. This cannot be compared to a mass, like a school shooting or a standard school shooting, because you got to realize in a school shooting, you're talking about someone who comes into a school with the intent to harm either, you know, certain targets or just anybody, you know, that they're, you know, coming in contact with. That's not the same thing as what happened with this situation. This young man did not go into school with the intent to shoot up the school. He basically had just been beaten up, and he was using the gun to defend himself against self-defense. So but they're saying some people are, you know, basically confusing this with a mass school shooting. It's not the same thing.
That has to do with what I was talking about earlier about the police department, okay? The Arlington Police Department, when they arrested and referred the charges, they do an initial investigation and they referred the charges. They referred the charges as unlawful carrying and three counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, you know, or, you know. Anyway, so what you get in that is that thing that you was talking about earlier, how the DA, once this got into Welchel's hands, he started doing his grand wizardry and just trying to freaking max this dude out, talking about terroristic threat. I got to get terroristic threat themed in there. I got to get all of this that in there so I can get him for capital murder. And then I can take away his life, you know.
The mother said, according to what you were saying, Adrian, that they were laughing when Jason made a comment. She said she got mad what he said when everybody started laughing. She said, "So this funny? It is not." And then she turned and looked at me, talking about the mother. Then the judge said something. So she was talking to the mother.
Okay. Thank you for
learning that. Miss Salinas, that's not right. I'm just saying. You don't talk to the crowd, Miss Salinas. But, you know, what I could gather from Prosecutor Salinas, she got a little hot tamale kind of personality. She seemed very feisty, very feisty.
Right.
And she seemed to get very frustrated very quickly at certain points during the trial. It's as though she had, in her mind, it was supposed to go like clockwork. And it seems that anytime anything derailed, she would lose it a little bit, you know, and try to, I don't know, it was just her demeanor would shift. it would be like she was thrown off by things did not turn out the way maybe she had planned them to. So I was very surprised. You know, so Attorney Reed is saying that there are no rookies, her and Welchel. So that's very interesting. If they're, you know, the top of the
that's what I
the class at
what
the
I
DA's
said.
Office.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Top, if you look at the history, you'll find all of the high profile cases in recent history. That's Welchel is the top gun. He's the headhunter for the Tarrant County DA. And the background, we talked about his background, but the background that's interesting to know about Salinas is that her husband is the former assistant chief of the Fort Worth Police Department who got in trouble a couple of times. He was one of Halstead's flunkies, and his name came up in some of that scandal when the Fort Worth Police Department got sued by the three black police officers for – you know, for a snowman with a noose on the neck and some other things that was going on, some retaliation. And and then, yeah.
Yeah, another thing, too, to mention, that another thing that they told in court, and Welchel said this, and it just wasn't true. He looked at Timothy and he said, yeah, you know, you're crying now. You know, they didn't get you no counseling. They didn't try to get you no counseling. You weren't remorseful, blah, blah, blah. But in actuality, I found a GoFundMe account that the family had put up just to specifically for Timothy to get counseling due to the trauma, for the trauma. So, again, things are said in court that just weren't true. And I don't think that's fair for the prosecution to basically make statements that weren't true, you know, and state them as facts. You know, because he was beating up on him pretty bad, talking about, you know, you're up there, you know, ain't nobody seen no tears, you know, before, and why didn't you get you some counseling and da-da-da. But they did try to get counseling for him. So that just shows you that there were some things that were said in the courtroom that were just not true. And you can find that GoFundMe account. It's still online. And so for you to do that... You know, that's not right. That's just my opinion. That's not right. And you
along
were saying
with what you were saying, along with what you were saying earlier before we came on the show talking about the other thing, too, is that they tried to paint the fact that he wasn't that nobody was trying to give the school any notice about these issues and everything. And, you know, like I'm sitting here saying, I think you mentioned to me that you had heard reports that the grandmother had been to the school, that they had tried to inform them about these issues, and that it was communicated to the administration. And, you know, that just feeds into the thing. I mean, if you're going to have kids that you know that, I mean, what we saw about that school was that's not a place where you want your kids going. You're talking of, even in the video, you got kids wandering around, two or three kids wandering in the halls, that are able to freaking, you know, and the classrooms are supposed to be locked. Well, you got two or three kids wandering around in the halls figuring out what kind of mischief they're going to get into. And then and nobody's there was no intervention. Usually there's people on the hall and they clear the halls. If you don't make it to class, you go to the office and you got to get a pass to get in the class.
The family is saying they have broken his car as well. I would love to know if anybody would like to share with me, or we can find out online this, why was Zach Selby not on the stand? Why didn't he testify? I would think if you know, I heard the teacher, you know, testify or give his, witness impact statement. But I would love to know why did not Selby get on the stand? Because to me, he would have been like, you know, the star witness, I would have thought. You know, if he's saying he, you know, his life has changed forever because of what happened, I don't know why he didn't testify. So that was very interesting that the person who this whole big thing is really allegedly, you know, well, let me take allegedly back. He's the one that was shot. He was the person that was the one that had just beaten Timothy up, and Timothy was responding to that. So I was very interested to know why he did not testify, because I would have thought it would have been very interesting to see that, but it didn't happen.
And that's an interesting
there's an interesting topic to discuss on that too, because in the, it's not necessarily broad across the states, but there's a statutory thing in a lot of states that they call something that, I mean, I wish Leon was on here to clarify it, but I know enough about it to say it's called res gestae, R-E-S-G-E-S-T-A-E, okay? And that's a legal terminology that prosecutors in a lot of states, they are not allowed to freaking leave gaps like that. If that what that term means is that the prosecutor has a statutory obligation to present the whole story, the whole truth, to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, you know, and as long as – now, if somebody's dead or, you know, if he was incapacitated somehow, that's fine, he wouldn't be. But in other states where they have this res gestae requirement for the prosecution, they have to call that witness and put that witness on the stand. They don't have to answer any questions, but they have to give the defense the opportunity to cross-examine him, you know. And
yeah, I think
so that, yeah.
I would think that his testimony would have incriminated himself on some level, because then you got to admit you started the fight, you know, which is then saying that you committed a crime because you jumped on someone, you know. And so I think him testifying to how did they get to that point would have opened up a whole can of worms. Well, did you rob? Did you have anything to do with the robbery? You know, did you do this? Did you do that? So I think him probably testifying would have probably incriminated himself on a huge level.
And
so,
and the other aspect too, if you remember, the lead police detective got put on the spot by the defense about him, because there was, you know, it came up about during the beating that he was stomping on his head saying, on blood, N-word, you know, three or four times he kept saying that. And, you know, that's a gang-related thing. Well, when the police reports came out and everything like that, they didn't mention there was a lot. What I'm thinking is, I don't know what the discovery was, but I'm saying that there was probably some things that the police and the prosecutors were scrubbing out and suppressing, you know, as far as Brady goes. And you're not allowed. I mean, if this dude was known, any crime, any kind of offense that he is known or that he's been investigated for, they're required to tell you all of that. If he's been on a gang active list, if the Arlington PD gang people know him, and it appears to me that the defense team fleshed that out, that the police reports and everything left every kind of reference to any kind of thing that he was a blood or that his brother, you know, the whole thing about his brother Isaiah, you know, in the original police reports, that the relationship there, yeah. That, so it was just off the chain what they were doing, you know.
There's a lot going on. It seems like to me when they are prosecuting these cases, that they create a narrative, and by all means they follow the narrative, no matter if it isn't always 100% the truth. They are trying to draw that picture, and they want the jury to see it like they see it. And so if they have to state something that may not be all the way true, I guess that's just what happens. And so I saw a lot of that, it seems like, in this particular case. So listen, we should get out of here. Adrian, you got any final comments?
No, just hoping all the best for Timothy's next chapter. You know, I'm sure he whatever the Most High has for him that it comes to, he's able to, you know, realize it and, you know, embrace it and walk into it. I was emotional, you know. I was emotional. I shouted. I shouted. Held my breath, but I shouted. You know what I'm saying? Because that life sentence, you know, they were trying so hard to get that life sentence, and like he deserved it. You know, thank the Most High for that jury being, you know, being able to listen with, not only with their ears, but, you know, have a heart to, you know what I'm saying? It's just so much I could say, but
Kerry, if I just share with you, since we got the fans to listen. Yeah, I just took it even a step high. I wrote the young man's name down, stuck it in my Bible, man. I'm trying to take my mind off of it, you know. And
wow.
I was thanking the Lord. After that verdict came down, I was thanking the Lord, not just because I just knew, yes, he got an opportunity now, you know. So to that family, all the best to you all. Thank you all for listening tonight and, you know, giving us a little tidbit so we can say what we need to say, you know, necessary corrections. God bless you all.
Yeah, you got shot with the point of order.
Wow. Listen, they had broken his car. I really appreciate everyone for speaking on it. That was his family. Listen, that was Timothy's family. Again, I reached out to them, I think probably with an hour's notice that we're about to do the show, and asked them to come on. And I do understand, in light of everything that's going on, them not coming on tonight, because I'm sure they still, you know, dealing with the verdict, the whole trial, you know, the media attention, so I get it. So I'm okay with that. Hopefully we can get them another time to come on and spend some time with us and tell us some more about the trial. Listen, y'all, this has been an interesting show. I thank Attorney Reed for stopping by tonight and enlightening us on the law aspect of all of this, the things that we don't know. She said, yes, when they're ready, they will. Well, thank you, Ms. Simpkin. That's Trina Simpkin. She said, yes, when they're ready, they will come on and talk to us. So I really appreciate that. Y'all, thank you, the audience, for listening tonight. Listen, follow us on Facebook. We're under Let's Talk Fort Worth. Y'all think we'd be talking over here. We always talking on the Facebook page that is always changing. Also, we'll be back Friday night. We'll be doing three shows this week. That never happens. So we'll be back Friday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Tune in. And listen, keep the news tips coming. Y'all were really good this week. Y'all kept me loaded with stories on this this Timothy Simpkin case, so I really do appreciate it. I ask you to please keep the news tips coming. Either hit me up on Facebook in the inbox for Let's Talk Fort Worth, or hit me on email at letstalkfortworth@aol.com. Also, y'all, I'm drawing a blank because I don't have any notes on the close like I typically do. So I'm just going to say this. Keep it locked right here on Let's Talk Fort Worth every Friday night from 7 to 9 p.m. as we tell you exactly what they're doing downtown. All right, y'all, until Friday night, we'll see you then. Good night.